Job chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the east. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the day of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. So far the reading of God's holy word.
Some girls want to get their worksheets, you can do that at this point. We're going to read from Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We're going to read from verse 8 to the end of the chapter, verse 20. I've been looking at Ecclesiastes in the evening services the last few times I've been preaching. And you'll remember that what we're looking at, this book, it's part of the wisdom literature, and the overall kind of theme is it's about a brief life in a fallen world under and before a sovereign God. Now, you remember the structure we've seen. There's an introduction and there's a conclusion, and in between it, there are 4 great sermons. And we're in the middle of, or in the second part of the second sermon tonight. The first sermon goes from chapter 1, verse 12, through to chapter 3, verse 15. And then the second sermon really began at chapter. I've just lost it. Hang on a minute. The second sermon began at chapter 3, verse 16, and goes right through to where we are tonight. The last time we looked at the first half or the first part of the second sermon, because in the second sermon, there are actually two main parts again, if you can. And in each sermon, in each part of the sermon, there's a negative view. It's called Under the Sun, what life is like as the wise man, the writer of Ecclesiastes, observes the earth and things in the earth, trying to find is there meaning to life without looking above. And then the second part of each sermon talks more about God. And that's what we'll see in this part from chapter 5, verse 8 to verse 20. We'll be looking at it under those two kind of headings, under the sun and God. And so let's read that together. Ecclesiastes 5:8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go, and what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in this toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. You remember in the first sermon that the wise man looked around him, and he to see in the natural world if there was anything could satisfy and give meaning to life, and he found nothing. He looked back in history and could find nothing there to satisfy him. He actually looked even within himself and his own experience of this world and this life. He looked at wisdom and pleasure. He looked at having a preeminent place, a position of power or a position of respect. He looked at hard work and throwing self into hard work, and he found that none of these bring meaning to life. The second part of the first sermon simply said, there is only a meaning to life when we see that all comes with a purpose with God. Everything is in God's hand. Everything is part of God's plan. Everything is full of purpose because it comes from God. Last time we looked at the first part of the second sermon, which goes from 3:16 to 5:7. And we saw that the man looked around, the wise man, he just saw that there's futility, meaningless in life under this sun. He saw that there was no justice in this world. He found that there was just oppression. He found that when he looked for meaning in work, that was just futile too. He looked around him and he saw loneliness and friendlessness, that people end up being lonely. He saw that power and popularity, that while they might give enjoyment for a while, were ultimately futile. And then, didn't we see at the second part of that sermon that all things changed when he looked to God and he worshipped God? And so what we've seen so far in the first sermon and in the first half of the second sermon is that it's when he saw God, when he saw that there is purpose with God, and when he worshipped God, that is where he finds meaning in life. And we're going to look at these verses which I've just read, and we're going to look at them again under those two headings, vanity or under the sun, verses 8 to 17, and then God, the last three verses. And as we look at Ecclesiastes 5, verses 8 to 20, I just want to ask you, what do they reveal to you that you realize life is worth living, that there's a purpose to life? What do these verses tell you so that you know life is worth living, that there is purpose to life? So let's look at what he observes again under the idea of vanity, or that this life is fleeting, that as he looks at life under the sun, his experience of life, what does he see? Well, in verse 8, all he sees is the oppression of the poor and violation of justice and righteousness. He looks around and what does he see? He said, the vast majority of people are in poverty and they are oppressed. Those who are rich or powerful are a very small minority and they oppress the others. There's a violation of justice and righteousness, he sees. And we noted these two truths before. You can see them in previous sermons. We saw it in chapter 3, verse 16 to 22, that there is no justice in this world, only wickedness, no true justice in this world. And we saw in chapter 4, verses 1 to 3, that there is only oppression in this world, no comfort for the poor. So there's no justice and there's no comfort in this world. One person, remember, who said about chapter 4, verses 1 to 3, he says it's a list of tears. He called it the crying game. All you see in chapter 4 are tears of the oppressed, tears of the frustrated, tears of the lonely, tears of the disillusioned. That sums up the life for most people. People end up in tears because there's no comfort in this life. The meaning of verse 8, the second half of verse 8 and verse 9 is difficult in the Hebrew. But the point of what he seems to be saying in the second part of verse 8 is this: that corruption is endemic in society. Corruption is endemic in society. Look at what it says in verse 8. If you see in the province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at this matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over him. So is this person, and they're being watched, and then there's somebody else being watched? I don't know if you're a Star Wars fan or not, but in episode 1 of Star Wars, they're in the water, and they're going to this underwater city in a kind of submersible, and there's this huge dinosaur-like creature chasing them. And suddenly an even bigger dinosaur creature comes and eats it up. And Liam Neeson simply says, there's always a bigger fish. That's what he's saying in Ecclesiastes. There's always a bigger fish. There's always somebody above you watching you. Watching you. And if you're in a workplace, you probably know that. Especially a very organized, structured workplace. You'll know there's somebody observing you. Organization in levels is important, and it can bring order, and it means things are done well, and there's good output. But the point of what's being said here in chapter 8 is that there's always endemic corruption. Whether there's somebody watching you for good reasons or for negative reasons, it always ends up in corruption. And there may be an implication here that there is an ultimate high official watching us, that is God. But that's not what's may not be true there or not, but that could be an implication. But one application we can take out of this is we shouldn't be surprised by these things. That there's a corruption, that there's oppression of the poor, that there's no justice and righteousness. He says in verse 18, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. Whether in society, in the workplace, whether in a local church or a church denomination, there can be corruption. And people do things for political or for selfish motives. This is not just to be purely negative and looking for negativity and corruption everywhere. It's just saying that it's there. The sinful heart of man plays its part. During this 50s and 60s, during the Cold War, there was kind of a saying in America particularly, everybody was looking for reds under the beds. They were looking for communists everywhere. And they were seeing communists where there weren't communists, but there were communists. But we can get so caught up with this, we just look for corruption everywhere. But there is corruption. There is corruption in society. And it shows itself in the oppression of the poor. It shows itself in that there is a violation of justice and righteousness, that there is no ultimate pure justice in this world. As Lord Acton's famous quote goes, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men. That may be a very negative view in life, but it's kind of what this is saying here. And so there's nothing new here. We've seen in the past in this book that there's oppression, that there's no real justice and righteousness. And here it's repeated. And so if he deals with that idea of oppression of the poor and violation of justice in verses 8 and 9, the rest of this little section from 10 to 17 is really about the love of money and the love of wealth. And what love of money and love of wealth brings is no satisfaction. That's what verses 10 to 17 are about. That love of money and love of wealth will not bring satisfaction, will not bring meaning to life, will not bring purpose. The main focus of verses 8 to 17, if you like, one commentator has called it the problem of stuff. Another one has called it the futility of wealth. Love of money, love of wealth, love of stuff will not bring satisfaction, will not give you meaning in life. And so, if we love money, as it says there in verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. Here's the reference to vanity, the meaninglessness, the futility of life under the sun. So what are some of the lessons that we learn about love of stuff or the problem of stuff here? Well, verse 10 tells us the reason we do not have satisfaction with stuff is because one never has enough. You will never have enough stuff. You will never have enough money. You will never have enough wealth to be satisfied. Money and stuff do not satisfy. And it's coming up to Christmas, one more week and it's Christmas. Are you aware of stuff being an issue at Christmas? Have you made lists of stuff you want or you really need? The word here, to be dissatisfied, in verse 10, when it says he who loves money will not be satisfied, it simply means, it's the kind of word that is used when you're eating a meal and you never have enough. Or you never get your thirst is never satisfied. I remember one time when we were younger, just married, and went out with another couple back in Belfast to one of those buffets, all you can eat. My friend, he went to the bathroom after he had eaten, and he couldn't get his trousers back together again. He'd eaten that much. He wasn't satisfied. You go to those bars and look. There's just so much, and you keep eating. I'm sure you won't be doing that over the next week. But Christmas, food, presents, stuff. It does not satisfy. Job was the richest man in the East, it tells us. I don't know how wealthy he would be in today's terms. But the man who was the richest American of all time was a man called John D. Rockefeller. His name is still in many places, in New York and other places. Someone asked John D. Rockefeller one time, "How much money does it take to satisfy a man?" Rockefeller replied, "Just a little bit more than he has." We're never satisfied. We're never satisfied. This is the richest American of all time. And he said, "I just need a little bit more than. This is what I have, but I just need a little bit more." Money, wealth does not satisfy us. Do you remember Paul as he passed on the gospel baton to young Timothy in the local church at Ephesus? Do you remember one piece of crucial advice that he gave to Timothy? "Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil." Love of money is not only dissatisfying, it is also a diversion. It will lead us into all kinds of evil. And so one of the problems with stuff is that one never has enough. Another lesson is, from verse 11, that others will collect and benefit from all your stuff. All the stuff you gather, all the riches you gather, the benefit will go to another. He says in verse 11, "When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage is that has their owner but to see them with his eyes?" It's like he's looking and he's seeing these people benefiting from what he has built up and what he has earned and worked at all his life. This may be one reason one feels they never have enough and that they're never satisfied. We observed this lesson previously, didn't we, in chapter 2, verse 18. Do you remember that? Chapter 2, verse 18 said, "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me." You work, and you pass it on. One reason stuff doesn't satisfy is that after all of your hard work, all the hours of the day you put into laboring and working through this life and accumulating wealth, even the whole of your life focused on building up your wealth, you don't know who's going to get it after you. You don't know where it's going to go. You don't know when you're going to die and who will benefit from all that accumulated wealth. It says in Psalm 39, verse 6, "Surely a man goes about as a shadow. Surely for nothing they are in turmoil. Man heaps up wealth and does not know who will gather." We heap up the wealth, but we don't know who's going to get it. Do you remember that we looked at this a few sermons ago when we were looking at chapter 2:18 in that section? Do you remember the story of the man who built more and more barns, and he looked at his wealth and he said, "My barns are full, so I'll build another barn." And in the parable, God comes to him and said, "Fool, for tonight your life will be ended." And we saw and asked the question, what barns are you building for yourself? What barns are you building in your life? What earthly treasures are you storing up for yourself? What heavenly and eternal investments are you looking at and storing up daily at working it at? As Gibson, a commentator, said, barns can be full of things like this: security, comfort, wisdom and knowledge I study all the time, good behavior. I can store up pleasures and accomplishments and hard work and think about my legacy, what I'm going to leave behind to the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I can look for approval. God says, "Fool, fool, for your life may be required. And someone else is going to get all these things, all the benefits for all your hard work." The very beginning of Ecclesiastes, we saw that little phrase in chapter 1, verse 3 that said, "What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" Under the sun, in this life, as you toil and toil and toil, what benefit do you get from that? Jesus put it this way, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and to forfeit his soul?" And so the problem of stuff one never has enough, verse 10, others will collect the benefit from all your stuff and your hard work. But also the problem with stuff is, as verse 12 teaches us, that it will bring sleepless nights. Have you ever worried over investments? Have you ever worried over stuff? Inability to sleep can be due to worry. You worry about your stuff. Or maybe you're working so hard you can't sleep. I remember visiting a man who was connected to our church in the country, in the churches I was in Ireland. And I went at 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night, and it was dark. And he was out in the fields in his tractor with the lights on. And it was winter, and I don't know what he was doing. But he just worked, a single man. He was engaged to a lady in the chemist for about 15 years, but he was so busy he never got around to marrying her. Work, work, work. Sleepless, can't sleep. Sleeplessness can be due to worry or just working all the time. But you see what it says in verse 12? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Will not let him sleep. You know the problem with stuff and riches? They're apt to disappear. They're apt to dissatisfy. Commentator Roland Murphy says this about the eyes. "It seems as if riches that the eye contemplates so vividly now keep them from being closed in sleep. We look and crave with the eyes, but now those things we crave keep us from sleeping." I had a friend in Dublin for many years, and he had two sisters who, over a period of time, had emigrated to Australia. And he told me, and my friend was a port missionary. He didn't really have any money at all. He just lived off by faith. He lived in a mission house and so on with his wife and two boys. But one of his sisters was incredibly wealthy out here in Australia, and she came to visit him in Dublin. And he said she took us out to a wonderful hotel, and he said the money she spent on that lunch was amazing. And we came out and got a taxi, and he said she went down the taxi rank and would only get into the 10th taxi because the others were too dirty for her to get into. But when she was staying with him, every day she went in from the suburbs into Dublin to the bank to check that her jewels that she'd put there while she was on holiday in Ireland were still there and safe. Every day. She didn't really sleep. And one of the problems with wealth is it attracts hangers-on. You ever know of boxers and entertainers, and when they become wealthy, suddenly all these people come out of the woodwork? Mike Tyson, for those who remember him, born in 1966, was the youngest ever heavyweight champion of the world at 20 years, 4 months, and 2 days. Today, he's worth $10 million. But when he was at the height of his fame, he had over $300 million. He's still wealthy, I suppose. But all these hangers-on, where does your wealth go? As Benjamin Shaw says, in the end, the only advantage is one gets to see more goods, but also gets to watch them leave. Yeah, you'll get wealth, but at some point they're going to leave, or you're going to leave then. And so in this section we see that the stuff does not satisfy. One never has enough. Others were going to benefit from it. It'll cause sleeplessness. And in verses 13 to 17, he kind of summarizes the problem of stuff. You'll see in verse 13, he says, "There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun." Under the sun. Here he is. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. As he summarizes having stuff, verse 13 says, what can you do with your stuff? Well, one thing you can do is hoard your stuff. Keep it. There's a house I drive past on the way to church. I won't tell you where it is. But all the stuff is spilling out. You can't see the veranda. It's in the veranda and it's in the garden. The cars look okay in the garden, actually. But there's all this stuff and it's just coming out of the garage. It's on the veranda. I don't know how they live in there. It'll all come in useful one day, I suppose, they think. I find those, I don't watch them, but those programs on hoarding, just depressing, the trailers. But that's what he's saying in verse 13. What do you do with your stuff? You can hoard it. Or he says another thing you can happen with it in verse 14 is that you can make a bad investment. You can lose it. So you can either hoard it or you can lose it. Verse 14 says, those riches were lost in a bad venture. A bad venture literally is the idea of a business transaction or something you do with business. You invest your money or you enter into an agreement with somebody or with a bank or some, and somehow you lose it all. That's what can happen to money, stuff. You can either hoard it and life becomes unlivable, or you can lose it all, is what he's saying. And the wisdom literature of God, there's a major truth, and we saw it in Job chapter 1, verse 21, didn't we? What did we read in Job chapter 1, verse 21? I'll read it for us. Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. You came into this world naked, you will leave naked. The Lord gives, but it will all be taken away, maybe during your life, or maybe when you die. You can't take it with you. A rich man was asked one time about his inheritance for his children. And he was asked, how much will you leave behind? And he said, everything. Everything. Naked, we go to eternity with nothing unless we need Christ. And you can see from verse 16 that he talks about this toiling with the wind. It's this idea of trying to catch the wind. Is that what we're doing in life when we have these just accumulating wealth? What he's saying in verses 8 to 17 is this: stuff can't be relied on or trusted. It disappoints rather than satisfies you. Stuff is liable to disappear sooner or later. Stuff will divert you from life's proper focus, which is God and his kingdom. One always wants more stuff. Stuff might appear to bring joy for a while. It might bring profit or comfort to your life for a while, but they're only fleeting experiences of what stuff really is, an evil, cruel, and hard taskmaster. Don't pursue stuff. The last few verses, verses 18 to 20, the focus moves from under the sun to God. This contrast we always see in these sermons, God. He says in verse 18, behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of this life that God has given. He brings together many of these themes he mentions time and again. Toil, working hard, that's what life consists of. Under the sun, living life on the horizontal without reference to God for a few days. Isn't that what Ecclesiastes is about? This brief life in a fallen world taken up with work, hard work. But as we've noticed in all the sermons, as we look around and are depressed and see no answer and see that life is not worth living, when we look around, see oppression or that money can't satisfy, whatever it is, the answer is not just to look around or look back in history, but to look up to God, to remember God, to see God. And that's what we see in these last few verses, these three verses, 18 to 20. Four references, four times God is mentioned. Do you remember the truth that we learned back in chapter 2, verse 24 to 26? The emphasis was on God as the giver. God gives. Everything we have, every blessing we have comes from God. That's why we read Psalm 103. Forget not all his benefits. Chapter 2, verse 26 said this, "For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and collecting and so on." Verse 24 of chapter 2 says, "All good things come from the hand of God." He's the giver. He's the giver. And that's what we see in these verses 5, 18 to 20. God is the giver. Verse 18 tells us that the things of everyday life, the things we often take for granted, food, drink, pleasure, work, these are gifts from God. And it's when we acknowledge God that we find joy and meaning and satisfaction, when we see that they are from God's hand, that these ordinary things, these everyday activities, there's where we find meaning. But they're not ordinary, they're gifts from God. We realize that they are not ends in themselves. That's why people who don't acknowledge God, who live under the sun, looking on the horizontal, never looking up, it's why they are dissatisfied. And verse 19 simply tells us that things, even wealth and possessions and power, these are God's gifts. These too are God's gifts. So to have wealth and a position of power, authority, are not bad in and of themselves. These are the gifts of God. And if we are in a position of authority or power in society, we need to use it for God's glory, not our own glory, but for God's glory first and foremost. You see, wealth and power and status and position are not ends in themselves. They're to be there, to be used from God. They're God's gifts. And verse 20 tells us about gifts, that they point to the man who has learned to number his days. He knows he will not live under the sun forever. So that man, that woman enjoys each day. His or her focus is not on his days and his living here and now. His focus is on God. And he acknowledges each day is a gift from God. And he acknowledges that all he is a gift from God. And he acknowledges that all he has is a gift from God. He is focused not inwardly on himself, but upwardly on God. And that all that he has and is from God. And he's not focused outwardly on stuff, but inwardly on the joy that comes and the inner peace that comes and flows from knowing God. And acknowledging God. Benjamin Shaw says, "Stuff disappoints because it isn't God." We could add, "Stuff disappoints because we don't acknowledge that it is a gift from God." You see, the truth is not merely that you and I live a brief life in a fallen world. It is that we live a brief life in a fallen world under a sovereign God who gives us everything. Is that not what we remember at Christmas above all things? How is the birth, the incarnation, the coming of Christ into this world portrayed? And how is it explained in the scriptures? It says, "For God so loved the world that he gave." Christ is a gift. Christ existed from all eternity, and he's sent forth by the Father, and he's given by the Father. And we ought to live each day thanking him for all that we have and all that we are, where we are in life, and using everything we have to acknowledge him and glorify him and live for him. That's where we get meaning in life. So as we finish this second sermon at the end of chapter 5, just remember that on three occasions we have looked already now at life under the sun and how it doesn't satisfy. But we've also seen in each time three things about God that gives meaning to this brief life in this fallen world. God makes for a life that is worth living. We saw in chapter 2, verses 24 to 26, that there is purpose in life with God. When we acknowledge God, life is a purpose because God has a purpose and a plan and is working it out. And when we see purpose with God, then we understand the meaning and purpose of life. And we see life is worth living. And so there's purpose with God. And we saw in chapter 5, verses 1 to 7, that when we see that, then there must be worship of God. And here the lesson is that gifts are from God. Do you see that it's when we look up, life has meaning? We see that there is purpose with God. We see that there is worship of God. Do you worship God in your everyday life? Do you give him thanks? Do you acknowledge that everything you are and all that you have are gifts from him? This is what makes life worth living. This is what gives meaning to life. And as we saw last time in chapter 5, verse 7, the great outcome of all of this is that you fear God. You fear God. Chapter 12, verse 13 of Ecclesiastes says this: "The end of the matter, all has been heard." And what's the outcome? "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." And some people say, well, this is Old Testament teaching. Where is Christ here? Christ came to reveal God to us, John 1:18, that sinners like you and I might know God, that we might fear God. And as Benjamin Shaw said, and I said last time, the fear of God passages in the Old Testament are the equivalent of faith and belief in the New Testament. When it says you fear God, it means you have a relationship with him. You have faith in him through Christ, and you believe in him. And you believe he exists, and you see that he orders all things, and you see that you are the person that you are by grace because of God through Jesus Christ. So may we, as we look around, and may we, as we navigate through this life, and may we, even in the next week, as we think about all the stuff around us at Christmas, may we see God. May we see purpose in this life. May we have meaning. May we worship God. And may we give him thanks for all that we have and all that we are. Let's pray.